This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Let's Talk About Myths, baby, and I am that host of yours, she who has somehow been able to dedicate an entire career to podcasting about women in ancient Greek mythology. Okay, fine, I also talk about men, but gods, you all know my priority is the women. Anyway, I'm Liv, and today I am here with such a fan favorite author that, I mean, gods, why even bother with an introduction at this point? Jennifer Saint is back with me to talk about her latest novel, the follow-up to Ariadne and Electra, Atalanta. Gods know we love Atalanta here, not to mention Jennifer herself. So, of course, I was eager to have her back on the show to talk about this latest novel and the one woman who gets to be a quote-unquote official heroine of ancient Greece, Atalanta. Atalanta is such a fascinating character. She's so complex, and her stories have so many versions and variations that she can really be so many things at once. And that is exactly what Jennifer has done with this latest novel, taken all of Atalanta's many forms and stories, the moments surrounding her, and turned them into a brilliant novel of one of the most badass and interesting women of Greek myth. The woman who hunted the Caledonian boar, who was raised by bears, who participated in a famed foot race, and who also sometimes, and certainly in this novel, was one of the Argonauts. Fucking love Atalanta, so let's just get right into this fun conversation. Unfortunately, I will just note that our audio here isn't as good as I would normally like. We had some tech issues at hand, but such is life. I am deeply not tech savvy, and regardless of how long I've been doing this, I'm still at the mercy of varied forms of recording and microphones and just a general lack of knowledge, and it's too many things. Anyway, Still, the conversation is worth any less than ideal audio, because gods know this author has you all absolutely hooked with her retellings of the women of Greek myth, and she's just generally really fun to talk to. Conversations. Atalanta the Argonaut. Reimagining Ancient Greece's Heroine with Jennifer Saint. I mean, okay, Atalanta is such an exciting character, so I'm so thrilled that you went and wrote a novel about her. So why don't you start by telling me, like, why Atalanta? Why do you love her? I'm sure it's a really similar reason to why I love her, so I'd love to hear it.
What really made me fall in love with her is definitely the story of the bears, that she's adopted by bears, and it is such a captivating image, and it's such a kind of fairy tale origin for somebody, that she is exposed by her parents, but instead of dying, she's rescued by bears, and she grows up ensconced in magic, it feels like to me, because that's just such an exciting way for her life to start. And that it's so symbolic of who she becomes, the way that the woman that she turns into, that she is just unlike any other heroine that I've written about. So that was a big draw for me, that she's somebody who I felt, when I really kind of drilled down into it and sort of what is it about her then that's making me feel like I want her to be the subject of this novel. And it's the feeling that with Atalanta, you can explore a woman who can grow up just untouched by gender expectations. That's really kind of what it felt like. It was like a sort of a thought experiment to think, like, what if we have somebody who grows up in a completely different world? And so when she does enter human society, when she does go on a quest with Jason and she does go and join the Argonauts, then she's going in with no preconceptions about who she is, because she hasn't been taught through her life that she is less than, or that she isn't worthy, or that she can't do things. She's been taught really to achieve her full potential. And to explore a character like that, coming from this fantastical beginning, which kind of gets turned on its head a little bit. I said it's like a fairy tale origin, but she is not a fairy tale princess. She is quite the opposite in every way. And everything about her story is unexpected.
Yeah, she is really fascinating everything you just said. And I like that, even the way you phrased it, you know, she's different from the other heroines that you've written about. And that's so true. But also the interesting thing about her is that she kind of, in this completely unique way, gets to actually like be a quote unquote heroine. Like, she is the only one that, you know, sort of the broad acknowledgement of Greek mythology, like, actually calls an official heroine, you know, to all the other heroes, versus these women who I think you and I would see as heroines in their own right, but they don't get to be like officially one. And like, do you have any, what do you think about Atalanta in that respect? Like, she is officially a heroine. What do you think makes her get that kind of designation that's so different?
So she goes on a hero's journey. She has that same arc. And I think there's so much, like, I've been asked a lot of times, having written novels about women in Greek mythology, this question that kind of comes up about writing strong female characters. And the thing about Atalanta is that her strength is maybe a more recognizable strength, a more traditional strength, because she codes in these more masculine qualities, I think, that people can kind of just accept, oh, here is definitely a strong woman because she can run really fast and she's like physically capable and she's a really good hunter. But that, to kind of just focus on that part of her, I think probably does her a little bit of a disservice, because she is, and anyone that you're going to write about that's going to kind of carry a novel is going to be a much more layered and complicated human being, that you're not just going to reduce her down to that kind of blunted edges, here is a woman who is a hero. But because she does go on that hero's journey, because she is in that respect like other heroes that we meet in Greek mythology, then I think
it takes away the expectation that she's going to necessarily be nice. It takes away the expectation that she's going to behave in a kind of the way that we might expect of women. I was really fascinated by the way with Atalanta. She's a devotee of Artemis, and so she swears off men, or Artemis asks her to swear off men. That's kind of one of the traditions of following Artemis. But that for me feels like, well, she's very adamantly not maternal in any way. And I kind of came off the back of writing Electra, where it was so much wound up with the story of Clytemnestra and how much she's driven by how powerful her maternal protectiveness and rage and vengeance is. It all kind of stems from motherhood, to then come and write about a woman who, well, that just doesn't factor in, where you can explore just a completely different adventurous kind of story that, you know, that you are free to do. If you have a male character, you are free to do that with Atalanta.
That's so true. That's why I love her, is because, like, I am a deeply, like, not into children person. And so it is nice. I mean, there is, like, that kind of, there's an end to Atalanta that I don't, yeah, you know, in the myth, but she really is, like, not maternal, like you're saying, in this fascinating way. But yeah, she's really interesting in that way. And it made me think too of your Ariadne, which I think is why my brain went off, is because you also wrote a really interestingly maternal Ariadne in a way that I hadn't seen her before. And I think it's a lot because I don't identify with people who have children. So I just, like, I never see these characters that way unless it's, like, really drilled in. But that always interested me as well. So yeah, it must have been fascinating to have this character who's, like, who's not maternal. But then in addition to that, what you said about, like, the way men are just, like, allowed, like, I've thought about it broadly that way because I'm a raging feminist who doesn't want kids, like, so it's kind of part of my life all the time, but it is so true that, like these stories of women always end up revolving around them getting married and having kids in, you know, every story of women seems to, in a way that it's, like, so unnecessary for the men. Like, if they do it, it's fine, but it's, like, it's never, like, the point of their story.
Mm-hmm. And I think when you come to writing any kind of historical fiction, when you have a female protagonist, then it is kind of baked in a lot of the time, because we are dealing with a world in which women don't have that autonomy necessarily, that control over their infertility and the ability to make a choice. And, you know, you were kind of skirting around the fact that there are myths in which Atalanta has a son, Parthenopaeus, if I'm saying that correctly. Sorry if I'm not.
I think you said it perfectly. Yeah. It's a hard word.
And I think we've said this before, but, like, you read and write these names so many times, and then you suddenly say them out loud for the first time, you need to go, is that how we do it? Anyway, but I like that there's different stories about him, because there's not, you know, her myths are quite fragmentary, but we still get the multiple versions. And with the story of him, there's a version in which she leaves him on a mountainside, the way that she was left on a mountainside. And you would think that kind of gives you a bit of pause, like, here's a woman abandoning a newborn. But I just felt like, well, do you know what? The Argonauts, on their journey, how many children might they have fathered along the way? I mean, deliberately, that was, like, part of the purpose. But also, you know, they sail away and I don't think they give it a second thought. So there is that feeling with Atalanta of kind of, can she have the freedom to be like that? And I think that version of her where she exposes her own child definitely made me think of it. And then there's a version where he grows up to be one of the seven against Thebes, and he marches off in the play. He has a shield with her depicted on it, and I love that idea that to him she is a warrior, and he's got this, like, respect and admiration for her as a warrior, but it's not necessarily kind of a mother and son bond in the way that I've explored in my other novels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I love that shield moment. I forget when I learned that. I was talking to somebody, I think, about those, that aspect of that, although, I mean, there's so many plays, but also just, like, generally the story of the Seven Against Thebes. And it is so lovely that, like, if we have to have this version where she does, you know, end up a mother, that we still have this, like, this strength associated with her, and, like, her son does go on to see her as this warrior. It's quite nice. So you mentioned the Argonautica, because, and I'm so excited about the Argonautica in this novel, and, like, just because I hate Jason, you know that, we all know that, but, like, I love the Argo because it I think it adds to the hatred of Jason, which is just that, like, he's just like one guy just like being kind of a dweeb on this ship full of cool heroes. And then, of course, like, unfortunately, she's not always on it, but we do have these sources where she is on the ship. So, like, how much fun was that? What did you love? Like, tell me about it.
So I particularly loved using the Argonautica, Apollonians of Rhodes, as the source text because of that moment where Atalanta approaches Jason and asks to be on the voyage, and he says no, and so she gives him her spear instead, and so he takes an emblem of her on board. And it just gave me so much satisfaction to think, I'm going to use this as my source text, but I'm going to write her back in, because that moment kind of spoke to me of, like, it suggests there was a dialogue going on in the between people telling these stories in the ancient world. Like, was she on board? Was she not? We've got all kinds of different lists of who the Argonauts were. There isn't a definitive version. But I liked the idea that maybe Apollonius was acknowledging, oh, some people put her in the story, but of course she wasn't there. That would be ridiculous. So that was a lot of fun. Yeah, so I think reading the Argonautica, it wasn't an epic that I was particularly familiar with. I didn't cover that at university at all. So I came to it quite fresh this time. And my familiarity with the Argonauts was probably from, like, movie and kind of other versions, like kids' versions of it, probably. So reading that, I just thought, wow, Jason does not make an impression in this epic. This is his quest. But where is he? He's just not, it's like he's totally absent. You know, Heracles, everyone, all the other Argonauts are like, why isn't Heracles leading this voyage? Which seems inexplicable. And even the way that he's referred to as the one-sandaled man, I just found hilarious. He's defined by the fact that he lost his shoe in a river. It's just, it doesn't really strike me into your heart. And He just doesn't do anything all the way through. He passes the book, other people make the decisions, and when they finally get to the Golden Fleece, it's so many parallels with Theseus and Ariadne, and that it's Medea who gives him a magical ointment so he becomes invulnerable, and he never proves himself, but somehow we come out of this with the idea that it's Jason and the Argonauts, where really it's the Argonauts and Jason just happened to be there. But it didn't really cement my hatred of him, because obviously I've given this a lot of thought since you did the episode about which is the worst, Theseus or Jason. Very on both sides. But really, like, Jason becomes actively obnoxious, I think, when we get to the post-Argonauts chapter of his life and the way he treats Medea, and particularly in Euripides' Medea.
Yeah, I agree. He's just so bland in the Argonautica. Like you said, he's just kind of there. And like, I had covered it, but it was an interesting way that I came at reading that, I think. But I remember one point specifically where I was reading those chapters about Medea. And like, it's like, she is the only reason that Jason is alive throughout all of it. It's so fascinating because, yeah, he doesn't seem evil in that. Like, that's why I argue that Theseus is the worst anyway, is because, like, I don't necessarily think that Jason is all that evil. I think he's just, like, an enormous dweeb who just, like, makes all the wrong decisions and just, like, doesn't do anything of value at all. So I just, yeah. So anyway, this is unfortunately not, well, not unfortunately, but not about Jason. But, like, how did you want to talk about Jason in your kind of take, like, because you're dealing with it from like such a different perspective as coming at it from Atalanta.
Yeah, so really thinking about how would we perceive Jason through the eyes of Atalanta. So here is this really ferocious woman who has grown up in the woods, who has like lived her whole life in nature where it's survival of the fittest. How on earth is she going to feel joining this voyage where the person in charge of it is somebody like Jason who has not proven himself whatsoever? And I think the whole of this voyage for her is kind of this learning about what heroism means to other people. And it's something that she's going in pursuit of, but how does she see other people achieve it? And because she's looking at it through an outsider's eyes, then I think she can really cut through a lot of what surrounds it, a lot of the kind of glamour and the mystique around it. And she really has the ability to see things as they really are. So I think that Jason, yeah, I really felt that he would not impress Atalanta, and that she would, she would not really see him as being the right person to lead this expedition. And I think that it's going to leave her with a great deal of disappointment and that kind of puncturing of illusions, because it's so much as well a coming of age story, and for Atalanta learning what the world is like and learning the ways in which it falls short. And who better to teach you about how the way that world can fall short than Jason?
That's exactly what he's good for. Absolutely. Like, yeah, I just find him so funny in that respect. Like, he's just such a wet blanket. Or like, as I had a guest on once who said that he had the personality of a used dishcloth, and I think about that a lot. He's just boring.
There is no discernible sign of a personality. You know, I mean, I guess he's ripe for being, for, you know, somebody giving him a personality. But I definitely, I took it very personally that in the Argonautica, he doesn't let Atalanta on board. I felt like there's a sign of somebody very fragile in their own masculinity, very much not able to cope with any perceived threat towards it. So, yeah.
Yeah, because even isn't it specifically that he's like, a woman can't come on board too? Like, he's like very... Yeah.
I think she'll be a distraction, you know, to all the men.
Right. Like girls who wear tank tops at school because they're hot, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I wonder, just in terms of like the Argonautica itself, whether that's, I mean, Apollonius, I always, for the longest time, I just like didn't really realize how late he was writing, because to me, just like having an epic that survives, feel like it must be from an earlier time. But yeah, like I wonder if it really has a lot to do with him writing in the Hellenistic period, where he's so far removed from Homeric epic. Because like, I could see, for all that the Homeric epic doesn't have a woman like that, like I could see Homeric style having an Atalanta on the Argonautica, whereas it seems to fit more of like later time periods to just be like, nah, women are all distractions. She can't come.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually. You just gave me like this absolute flashback to sitting GCSEs. I remember all the girls being brought into the hall. This is like the exams we take when we're 16 in the UK, and being told you must cover up for your exams because they're in the summer, and because otherwise boys might fail their GCSEs and not get any qualifications, because they, how would they be able to cope if they saw a girl's shoulder?
Oh my God, the fury that fills me with. Like, it's, and the idea that it's about the girls, it's about us having to change something about how we are comfortable in the moment just because men seemingly have absolutely no control over themselves. Like, oh my God, I hate that that's such a common story too. Like, that's, it's everywhere around that idea that like women have to cover up for the men's sake.
Exactly. And I just think we're taught from such an early age that we have to make accommodations, we have to change our behavior, like we can't go out after dark, we can't do this, we can't wear that, because we, otherwise men can't be trusted to be responsible for their own actions. And that's I guess Jason's approach to the Argonauts. I mean, he might be right about some of them,
but it's not Atalanta's fault. That's the key.
Exactly. And she is well able to hold her own against them.
Exactly, yeah.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's funny, the timing of this chat. I hadn't really thought about it in advance, but like, so last week I covered Thetis, and I don't even think I mentioned it because I wanted to make the episode about Thetis and not about Peleus, but it reminded me that there is an instance where Atalanta and Peleus wrestle and she beats him. And like, yeah, it's, I mean, did you, Peleus is on the Argonautica. How did you handle him? He's such an interesting character because like, I feel like I hate him because of Thetis, but like that bit of the story is quite removed from her.
So yeah, I definitely, taking his character, I really went with what he does in order to force her into marriage, which is that he wrestles her into submission, like because he is a great. So I really felt that, okay, well, so Peleus is a rapist then, and therefore I have no time for him. And there is that myth around Atalanta defeating him in a wrestling match. Just feels like such a revenge fantasy, doesn't it? That kind of, here he is, this is what he does, and this is what he did to his wife, who did not want to have anything to do with him, and who jumped back into the sea as soon as humanly possible to get away from him. And then there's kind of like a fantasy version in which Atalanta defeats him. So yeah, it was quite easy thinking about the Argonauts, thinking about there's 50 men. All of my novels have kind of put men in the sidelines, in the background, like they're not the focus of the story. And then here I am suddenly writing one where there is a whole boatload of men. It did give me the chance to explore some different kinds of men and to figure out who are going to be the antagonists in this story of Atalanta and who are going to behave differently towards her, because there are so many of them that you can explore like a range. And Peleus seemed, because of that story, he seemed like somebody who would be an antagonist, who would be, like Jason, threatened or offended by the very idea of a woman on board.
Yeah. I was glad to have all of that. So we're talking about Atalanta today, but I also have to say that I'm now starting on a series covering Euripides' Orestes, and I'm just being reminded of how much I love Electra. So it has me thinking of your Electra novel too. And like, Euripides' Orestes is so weird generally, but I just love Electra. And I did kind of in theory have a point to that statement, but it just came out of just thinking about your other novel again too, because Electra's such a badass.
Yeah, she is. I mean, I said like, oh, I get asked about writing strong female characters, and her strength comes across so differently to Atalanta's. You know, it can feel like such a sort of diminishing term, I think, sometimes. And not that I have a problem. We need to have shorthand to talk about books and like literary analysis. But yeah, it's just a reminder that there are just different ways in which women get to show their strength in these myths. And like, there are not very many of them like Atalanta who can do it so physically. And with Electra, she's much more of a like a kind of Lady Macbeth character. It's through her influence over other people, right?
Yeah, that's why I love her a lot. She's also, it's just more violent, and I like that. I mean, Atalantis is violent, but like in that heroic way where it's like it doesn't count in the same way.
No, it's much more acceptable violence.
Yeah, well, that is an interesting thing generally, just the way you phrase that too. So now that you have three novels of amazing mythological women, it occurs to me quite how distinct they all are. Like, even just when it comes to your books, you know, they're sort of the like covers and things kind of tie them all together, rightly so. You've written all of them and they're all mythological women, but the differences between Ariadne, Electra, and Atalanta are enormous. And like, I don't know if I fully have a question about that so much as I find it very interesting. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you picked them just because of all the things about them that make them, you know, these characters that we love. But was kind of, I mean, what was your like the most interesting thing of having to write novels about these three characters who are so very different in all of the mythology?
Well, I think something I really love about writing Greek mythology is that you do get to kind of genre hop a little bit within Greek mythology, because like, you know, the Iliad and the Argonautica, two epics so very different in tone. Like we've said, the violence in the Iliad is devastating and cataclysmic, and in the Argonautica it's kind of, it's part of the fun, because it's like, I guess, the equivalent of like an action movie now where, you know, the body count doesn't really matter. So it's, yeah, so that's a really appealing thing for me, I think, that I can write these very different feeling novels about these very different kinds of women. And I think with Ariadne, the kind of the tone of it for me was really one of tragedy. Not that she always has a tragic story, but because when I was writing it, I was looking at her story in the context of all these other stories about women, and like coming back to that theme of they are always the ones paying the price, and the men are just walking away. And so Ariadne got tied up with her mother Pasiphae and Medusa in the novel, and Phaedra, and all the things that happened to them that fit into that theme. And so that was really about expressing sadness about that scenario, that like all too familiar scenario that we come across. Whereas when it came to writing Electra, then that sadness had given way to anger, and it was about women really hitting back and taking control of their own destiny, even though the odds are still set very much against them. It was about women really not being afraid to use that anger. And then when it came to time to write Atalanta, I was just really ready for something joyful, for something that felt triumphant, for something that celebrated women in a much more uplifting kind of way, which isn't to say that there aren't dark elements to her story and her character, but it definitely, I felt like, do you know what, I'm ready to move out of Greek tragedy, I'm ready to move out of the kind of the dark melodrama, and I'm ready to kind of have something a bit more, a bit brighter, and something that feels, just so much of it felt like so much fun to write. And so I really hope that people find it fun to read as well.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it, that would have been so much fun to write, because you're right. Like it, I mean, I like to just hear that kind of the progression that you had. That's so, it's like beautifully kind of like woven all together. But yeah, Atalantis is so interesting because she just really is like so much fun. I've been thinking, and I was talking to Jen and Jenny after they spoke to you, because we were all coordinating. We do these things accidentally and accidentally have you like back to back on our shows. But like I thought of the two episodes I did on Atlanta where I kind of wanted to examine her as these like two different people, because they are so, depending on, you know, how you're taking the sources, and it's a lot of my own interpretation too, but that to me, they feel very disparate. It's like the Atalanta who gets distracted in a foot race and loses versus this Atalanta who is like generally this impeccable, like hardcore hero who doesn't care about men and all these different things. Like, she just feels so sort of fascinating. Then we also have the regional things where it's like there are these two kind of regional Atalantas. But I know, so you wanted to like put it all together, and rightly so. It gives her so much more going on. But how did you kind of come at those aspects of her?
Yeah, so it was really hard to tie those elements together. The foot race was what held me back from writing the novel for a little while. So it started out as a short story. I'd written a short story about her, and I thought, this just feels like it could be a novel. And actually, of course it could be, because there's so much to her story. And then I thought, but if I tell Atalanta's story and I include the foot race, how am I going to do that? Because, I'm writing like, here I am, a feminist in the 21st century, and I'm writing about women. And so there's the feminist angle to these novels. But the story of a woman who loses a foot race because she becomes so distracted by the pretty shiny apples and then gives up her freedom. She said she wasn't going to get married, and then she gives it all up for the apples. I thought, that feels so anti-feminist. That feels, how can I turn that into something that makes sense and fits with that pretty ruthless woman that we've seen in the previous stories, the woman who fought against the Caledonian Boar, the woman who joined the Argonauts? And what happens to her to make her that woman who we see less as that warrior who's grown up in the wild, and more as this woman who is living in a palace, daughter of the king, trying to assert her independence by saying she won't get married, but then going ahead with it. So I don't really want to give away.
I know, I was like, also that. How many spoilers are in here too, so watch, but yeah.
I think we're kind of talking broadly about Atalanta's mythology, right? So I'm not, when I say that kind of these are things that happen in her myths, I'm not necessarily saying that I did all of them in the novel. People will have to read it to find out. So I had to, it led me down a rabbit hole of what the golden apples are, first of all, and what they represent. And I got so fascinated with that. And that actually, if for all your North American listeners, if you pre-order the exclusive edition from Barnes & Noble, you will get a bonus short story about the golden apples, which is exclusive to Barnes & Noble. You can only get it there. Because I was so interested in where they originated, that they were a wedding gift from Gaia, primordial goddess of the earth, to Hera, the queen of all the goddesses, and that it's a wedding gift just to Hera, not to Zeus and Hera. So I thought that suggested to me there's like a passing down of female power. There is significance to these apples. They matter. They've come from Gaia. They've gone to Hera. Then they appear in these other myths, like the beauty contest, that sparks the Trojan War. And they're one of Heracles' labors as well. So these are apples which are coveted desperately by immortals. They're coveted desperately by heroes. They're apples which prove something significant about the person who gets to own them. So that makes more sense, rather than she has just seen something shiny in the distance. And so she's going to give up the race. It makes more sense that these are the apples that symbolize that heroic value, that divine importance as well. And that makes it, that gives it a little bit more context why she might throw that race. And I like the way that Ovid tells it in the Metamorphoses, where she kind of throws the race on purpose, because she actually chooses Hippomenes. So you still have, I think, the sense there in the way that he approaches the myth, that she's a woman in charge of her own destiny. And that's the really important thing, the crucial thing not to lose in that story.
Yeah, that's the thing about it, right? And I'm glad you mentioned Ovid's version, because, I mean, I do love what he does with everything in Metamorphoses, or for the most part. But yeah, I mean, And it's interesting because the Greek versions are so fragmentary when it comes to Atalanta too. So it is tough to say, and they tend, you know, but I talk about this a lot, but the difference between most of the Greek myths and something like Ovid is like intentionality. Like Ovid sat down to write a book, whereas the Greek myths were like developed and oral storytelling and all of that. And I think it says a lot about how little context we get in Greek myth and how little of like that, I mean, agency broadly, but agency because we don't know anything about these people as people. That's just like these things that happen. And it's both frustrating to us as like readers, but it also, I think, for somebody like you, provides a lot of open-ended things to work with, because we don't get like much of Atalanta in terms of a personality in the Greek sources. And that means you can kind of give her whatever you want. In terms of like what, you know, what you feel is best for the way you're writing her story into a novel. And so, I don't know, another, like, it's not a question so much as I just, that's a fascinating thing for me when it comes to Greek myth. And my personal, like, while I'm still working on a novel, it'll probably never be finished, but I find the same thing. It's like, my characters don't have personalities in the myth, so I can kind of do what I want. And at the very least, yeah, when it comes to the golden apples, like, you have that kind of freedom to both examine them as what they are, and then also be like, well, here's like, you know, there's other reasons why this could be happening, and it's not just that, like, yeah, girls like shiny things.
Exactly. And I think that when you get kind of multiple retellings, because there are so many mythological novels, is particularly coming out this year, and that might examine some of the same characters, but one author's take on them will be so different. And I find that really fascinating, that you can follow the same broad structure of storyline, you can have the same events, but by changing the personality of the character, well, by giving them a personality, like you say, then you completely change that story. And so you can see a totally different version of that character.
Yeah, it adds so much. And it's, I mean, yeah, it's why I think all these mythological retellings can be doing so well, but also why, yeah, it's, you know, we're never going to run out of this stuff to work with, because you really can do anything. It reminds me of the Ariadne and Dionysus retelling that's coming out next year. That's like a space odyssey in addition to being Ariadne and Dionysus by Kate Corrane. And it's like, you know, we get these, like, you can tell it's the same base story, but I have a feeling it won't resemble yours at all, you know, and they're like, these two things will be able to coexist so completely. And I think, yeah, that applies to so many things.
Interviewed Helen Lovett as well,
in, yes,
who wrote Iago. Yeah, right. So yeah, so she has got all of these, she draws together in that book, Exploring the Argonauts, all these different kind of versions, mm-hmm. doesn't she? And so Atalanta comes up in Emily's book. She comes up in some more modern versions. So that prompted me to buy a really brilliant children's version, actually, by Felicity somebody, which I don't have to hand. But that's a really great illustrated version where Atalanta is completely like one of the heroes. She's not sexualized at all. She's not feminized at all. She's just like, she's there having a great time on board. And I love seeing that, because I've kind of mentioned sometimes, oh, I don't know that all the children's versions sort of give women, the female characters, much of a role. And, you know, is there much in it for girls reading Greek mythology? But there obviously are versions out there. They do exist. And so I definitely don't want to negate the existence of those. And that was a really great one. If only I could remember the name of the author, that would help.
I mean, it's Googleable. We'll be fine. But, and I'm sorry, I don't want to also like take away from your book. Obviously, we're here talking about your Atalanta. I just get excited about all of the varied Greek mythological everything.
I've just seen it. It's Felicity Brooks, by the way.
Okay.
Felicity Brooks. For anyone listening who has kids.
Yeah, that's the thing. The kids stuff that's good to know, because I'm always asked to recommend or do stuff for children. And I'm like, I will not write things for children, because I do not. interact with children, and I have no idea what they should or would like, but other people have done it, and that's great. That reminds me, that was the other thing that was the timing of our chat is so interesting, because I spoke to Helen Lovett back in, I think, like September or October, but the episode just came out like last week, and I didn't really recognize that it was coming out so close to yours. And now I think it's a perfect kind of an accompaniment, because like you say, she's written about the Argonauts, but in a very historical way, where she has broken down like every single reference to them from like, you know, the earliest in ancient Greece to like yesterday, which I think is super fascinating because they are kind of everywhere. Unfortunately, not always with Atalanta, but, you know, at least enough.
Yeah. And she gives a whole chapter to Atalanta and Medea and the women who are part of that story. So I missed the episode because I was in Rome last week. So I will make sure I catch up on that.
Yeah, you've got good timing. So that you said the word Medea. And so like, how did you want to come at the fact that like there are these interactions between these two?
So, Medea and also Hypsipyle were the two key other women in this novel. I thought, how are these women going to come across to Atalanta? Because they are also extremely powerful women in this world. They are also women who wield a lot of independence and who are making things happen. But they're coming from such a very different place to Atalanta and with very different kinds of motivations. And what I really didn't want to fall into was some kind of idea like just because they're women that they're going to develop a kind of sisterhood necessarily, and that they are going to be great friends just because they have those particular things in common, because they are individuals and that's not necessarily the way that these things work. So, but they were such other brilliant characters to explore, and I found with Medea in particular it was trying not to give the novel over to her when she comes into it, because she very much demands and she takes over the story at that point. As soon as they land in Colchis, as soon as they're there, everything gets handed to her, doesn't it? And she's the one telling Jason what he's going to do. The rest of the Argonauts are sidelined, and she's the one who masterminds their escape as well. So it was really difficult to sort of to remind myself all the time, no, this isn't her story. I am not telling her story. And the way that she operates in the sphere of a kind of a darker sort of magic, the way that she goes to the crag where Prometheus is to gather the flowers that have sprung up from his blood. There is something by the light of the moon. It's so occult, that moment. It's so sinister. And it's really at odds to the way that Atalanta operates, because she is much more somebody who's out there kind of fighting in broad daylight rather than kind of wielding that kind of influence and that kind of power. So there was definitely going to be some friction between them. There was definitely going to be something of a clash when they come into contact with each other, and a kind of recognition of like, oh, look, here we are, these two women in this world, kind of in our own sort of unique roles, in our own unique spheres. But are we necessarily going to gel all the time? And also, Medea is inexplicably in love with Jason, and I don't think Atalanta's going to really comprehend that.
That's because that's what I love about Apollonius, is that he's like, the gods did it.
Yeah.
And it's so refreshing to have that, because yeah, if you're looking at it from the outside as a human, it's like, no, why, what, like, what do you see in this man?
Well, I mean, all I can think of is he represents an escape from the life with, and the father who is a tyrant. So and Jason is the opposite to that. I suppose she might look at him and think, he will never be tyrannical, he will never treat me the way that my father treats people, so he's a good person to run away with. And I guess she realizes that that she's got the upper hand.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have like one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, okay. I've got so many other questions. I'm curious, like, how, so this whole story features so much more, I mean, the sort of quintessential heroism, and what that comes with is, like, probably a very different way of having to write these moments, like, more action, and more of that kind of, yeah, that, like, things like the Caledonian Boar and the Argonautica and stuff. So, yeah, was that fun? What was that all? I don't know. I'm just fascinated by it.
Yeah, it was. And so it was. It from a really escapist perspective, it really was. And it was not something that came naturally to me to write action scenes, to write scenes of Atalanta running and enjoying running for somebody who does not. I would only run away if I was being chased by something. But it was that's one of the joys of writing novels, that you go to another world, that you inhabit a different mind. And Atalanta was so different to me in so many ways, and her experiences are so action-packed. It was really good to kind of flex my writing muscles that way a little bit, and to get to write battle scenes and things like that, which I had to go and research how people things about like wrestling, for example, like actually what, because there are sort of instructions that we can read of you know how ancient Greeks used to wrestle. So I was reading up on their moves so that I could incorporate them, and that was really interesting. It kind of opened up a whole new world of research to me as well. And also the idea, as I was in Athens for a writing retreat earlier this month, and when the guide was taking us around the Acropolis, and she was talking about the Temple of Asclepius, and she was talking about how medicine, how the mind and the body was so much more closely linked in the ancient world than it necessarily is today, where there's more of a kind of a dichotomy, like you are clever or you are athletic, can quite the way people feel, whereas there's much more this holistic idea of nurturing the mind and the body and the spirit all together, and educating yourself while also training to be physically strong. And so I really wanted Atalanta to embody all of that, and that she's not just all brawn either, and that she's got like a much more rounded development in her story as well.
Yeah, that's so true. And that's fascinating, like having to actually read into like wrestling instructions, because you're right, though, they took it so seriously. Like wrestling was a big thing back then. And I love the idea of getting the accuracy down to that level. I think about like weapons and stuff too. Like that must have been so interesting, like figuring all of that out and how all of it functions.
Yeah, it's so much more technical than anything I'd done before. So that was, it's great to kind of find out about it.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this a lot in my own writing. Like, oh God, like, yeah, it's just, it feels like so daunting, but also so fun and interesting. And like this whole other side of the ancient world to examine. And like, you also got to talk a lot about, like, I mean, she goes on this voyage, she goes on this hero's journey, so like, you know, you got to cover so much of a wider area and stuff too. Did you, you know, maybe like, did you particularly learn anything wild that you really loved having about like the regions in Greece? Or I don't even know, I'm just happy to talk about this stuff.
So also people have traced out maps of the Argonauts' voyage as well, and kind of actually figured out where they might have gone. But of course, it's a mythical geography as well, because you go to these places and somewhere there are six-armed giants, for example, inhabiting, like they look like giant boulders, but then they get up and they start fighting. The clashing rocks as well was really interesting. And I know that people have come up with sort of rational explanations for all of these things, but I am always in love with the magic. So I liked the fact that these different regions were characterized by something, I guess, like in the Odyssey, by something that is unknown and something that is fantastical and improbable and very perilous. So it was really fun creating those different dangers along the way, and how you can be incredibly skilled with your bow and arrow hunting, but maybe that's not so useful when you are on a ship between two massive rocks that are going to slam together and crush you between them at any moment. So here's a different situation to be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously, like, I love the Odyssey more than anything, so it just makes me always think about that stuff, those, like, the mythological journeying. I love the idea that there are these places that are, like, just myth. Like, we don't have to rationalize them. Like, they're just wild mythological locations. And it makes me think of the gods and stuff too, which I realized. So you had to write this interesting relationship between Atalanta and Artemis and stuff too. Like, she's this devotee, but then of course, like, things change, like, or I mean, in terms of men and everything. Like, how did you go about her relationship with Artemis?
So I definitely had Artemis involved with her from a really early age because, so mythologically speaking, Atalanta, after the bears, she's adopted by hunters. And I think that's often construed to be male hunters take her in. And so she does grow up as part of human society. And to me, it seemed to make a lot more sense that she's in the forest of Artemis. Why would she not be taken in by the huntresses who already live there, belonging to Artemis? So that just seemed to fit a lot better for who she is and who she becomes. But that means that Artemis is a stand-in for a mother figure, kind of the closest one that Atalanta has. And Artemis is herself famously not maternal and not in any way human. So it's really interesting to create relationships between gods and mortals because they are just on a different plane to one another completely. And it was, when it comes to Artemis, she's such a fascinating goddess that she is the goddess of hunting. And then she's also the goddess of childbirth at the same time, which at first I found to be quite contradictory because it seemed that one was about death and the other one was about life. But of course it makes a lot more sense because they are both about facing, particularly when we think of like doing this in the Bronze Age, facing a really physically grueling ordeal that you might not come out of alive. And Artemis having that role of kind of protecting young women and seeing them through to that transition, at which point it becomes about worshipping Hera or other goddesses, but Artemis kind of has them until then. I found those really interesting aspects to try and bring out in her relationship with Atalanta. And also just to explore with the reader how Greek gods, the immortals, they are not just superpowered humans. They are something different, and Artemis is something different. And the other myths that we know most famously attached to Artemis are the myths of Callisto, the myth of Arethusa, and obviously Actaeon, where he comes across her bathing naked. And we see that scene played out so many times in stories, in the Metamorphoses, on Greek vases. We see like women being seen by these predatory men while they're in this vulnerable state. But when it happens to Artemis, she turns it around on him. And it's such a cruel and seemingly totally unjustified punishment that what she does to Actaeon. But it really underlines, well, she's not working with our sense of morality. She's not working with our sense of justice. She is working with her own imposed framework that is incomprehensible to people watching and is really hard to accept. But that is because she's a goddess. That's because she's an Olympian. So I really wanted to make that clear that she is not just kind of another human-like character with just a bit more power, that she is something altogether not human.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. They are so interesting to think of when you have gods interacting with humans in modern fiction, because trying to convey that when it was just sort of something fully understood in the ancient world, it's a fascinating thing. I love Artemis, and she does play such a perfect role of like raising a child almost literally, because she is this like protectress of young girls. She's badass. So okay, like I feel like we've covered so many things, and I also don't want to get into spoilers. And it's difficult when you know the myths, trying to decide what is a spoiler and what is not, because I know everything that happens in all of the myths. But I know you do such intense research, including just like wrestling research, which I love. But was there something, like, did you learn something really wild and cool that's now a favorite fact, maybe, in any of your research?
Yeah, I'm gonna, it's not mythical. So I learned about bears, and that was one of the most fun things for me. I watched a lot of bear documentaries. I watched a lot of clips of bears on YouTube. I had pictures of bears all around me. And I learned about the way that they are, obviously, we know mother bears are famously very ferocious in the way that they protect their cubs, and you never want to get in between a mother bear and her cubs. And they are absolutely terrifying. But then when it comes time for the cubs to live independently, then they turn on them really viciously and chase them away. So it's this complete reversal, which I found very upsetting for the poor baby cubs, but a very formative part of their growing up to become, useful members of bear society themselves. that to me became so emblematic of, well, this is what nature is like. These are the cycles of nature. Nature is something so very ruthless, so very cruel, but so brilliantly efficient, and you know, does the job. And it fitted so well. It seemed, you know, that the bears are associated with Artemis. They're a sacred animal to her. We can definitely see why, that the bears have got this connection to Atalanta. It's just when things come together so beautifully and you just think, yeah, it could only be bears that rescue her. And kind of in parallel to that, I did have to do research into cases of like real life wild children, as in children who have like been abandoned in the wild. But those cases tend to be incredibly upsetting because these are neglect and abuse and all kinds of awful things. But what interested me about that, what I was trying to sort of figure out, was how you learn language if you are not raised by people talking to you. And there is, I think, a theory that there is this sort of critical window where if you don't learn language, you will never be able to access it fully. The kind of the connections in your brain just don't form. So that was sort of a conundrum with Atalanta. I did not want her to grow up only able to communicate in growls and bear language. So that was something to think about, when to bring her out of bear society and into something that would make her able to participate in the rest of the world.
Yes, that's really interesting. And the bear stuff, and the number of times you use the term bear society, which might be one of my favorite things now. The idea of bear society. Okay, well, that's the other thing about Atalanta, is that she features in to so many different myths. She has so many different like little bits and pieces. She kind of gets to be everywhere. So what is your favorite bit about Atalanta's story, myth, whatever she's involved in?
Okay, I'm not going to say my favorite one, because if people don't know it, I don't want to tell them it. But people who do know it are probably going to know exactly what I'm talking about and why I don't want to say it. But it's so much my favorite, and I wish that we could discuss it. So I'll pick another one. Another really great thing of Atalanta. I mean, probably the one that I found the most enjoyable to read probably was her wrestling match with Peleus. But I love the Caledonian boar hunt. And I love the way, I love the way that Ovid tells it, where I think what I really like about the Caledonian boar hunt is that Atalanta has a rightful place there. That she joins this, it's another time when she joins a band of heroes. And that although it could be argued that Meleager might have an ulterior motive in awarding her the tusks and the hide of the bear, because she's the one who draws first blood. And maybe he's doing it because he wants to seduce her. And that's a very effective way of seducing a woman. Well, it probably is for Atalanta, that you give her some boar tusks. But I like my first reading of it, which was that he just recognizes that she did a great job and that she deserved it. And when I was talking about Jason and Peleus and how their masculinity is threatened by her success, I liked the idea that maybe we've got a man in Greek mythology whose ego is secure enough that actually he can say, oh yeah, she was the one who drew first blood. She can get the prize. Well done, Atalanta.
I've always loved him for that too, because I like that reading where he's just like recognizes her actual worth instead of having some weird Greek man ulterior motive. Yeah,
and it just shows you like it exists even in ancient versions, that you can have a man with that sort of egalitarian approach, that you can have somebody, you know, interacting on a much more sort of human and normal level. And it's not like an invention that I might impose on it in a later retelling, or here I'm going to put in this nice guy who understands, or he's a feminist too or something. I'm not trying to impose those kinds of values on my characters. They live in a different world. They don't have access to these same ideas. But there is a precedent in ancient literature for Meleager being kind of pretty, you know, decent. So
Yeah, absolutely good for him. He's one of the few I could ever name. And so it's great to have him in this space where he is not a jerk. So rare.
Exactly.
My gosh. Well, this has been so much fun. Do you want to tell my listeners everything about getting your book? I will link to things too, and where to follow you and everything. And then I'm going to ask you your favorite and we're going to cut it out. because I want to know.
Okay, so yes, so well, you can get Atalanta anywhere where you get books. You can get it in all bookshops, and you can get it on audiobook, you can get it on ebook, whatever your preference is. It will be out in the UK on the 13th of April, and it'll be out in North America on the 9th of May. I think it's the 9th of May that it's coming out, early May definitely. And yes, that's where you can get it from. That was what you asked me to say, wasn't it?
Yes, and I realized I didn't need to, because I can tell people too, but I said it. But yeah, what about following you? Do you want to promote other things, what have you?
Oh yeah, sure. Okay, so I am don't bother with Twitter. I am not up to date with my Twitter. If you see me, just don't bother with Twitter. I don't like it. It's not doing me any favors. So come and find me on Instagram, jennifer.saint.author, where everything is much nicer.
That is very true. I'm still on there, but I don't check it very often. And I did actually go recently look for you and saw that you have your like little notification of like, I'm not on here much anymore. And I respect it. Yeah.
Things are getting filtered through to me. So basically, if you contact me in a positive way, I will at some point see it. And if you want to say something unpleasant, I won't. So don't bother.
That's nice. Yep. That's a good way to live. I support this.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It's always so lovely to have you and to talk about mythology, which is just so much fun.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me back again, fourth time. I'm so pleased that you still think I might have something interesting to say, and I will always endeavor to try.
Thank you. As always, I love being able to have authors on to talk about their mythological retellings and novels. It's such a thrill for the myth nerd in me, or the myth nerd part of me, and the formerly of publishing part of me. Like, it's really the best of all worlds as far as I see it. Plus, chatting with Jennifer is always so lovely. Gods know we've had a great time in the past. Atalanta is available now in the UK and North America, so check it out and read a beautifully intricate reimagining of everyone's favorite heroine, or sometimes also the only woman who gets the designation as heroine. I mean, at least there's one, and she's awesome, right? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians gods. She handles so many podcast-related things, from running the YouTube to creating promotional images and videos to editing and research and so much more. Stephanie Foley works to transcribe the podcast for YouTube captions and accessibility. The podcast is hosted and monetized by iHeartMedia. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. Thank you all for listening. You are super cool, and I'm just so fucking thankful that you all helped me to keep this my career. I mean, God, I honestly can't thank you enough for listening. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm Ilya Kani, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.